个玻璃心。给你那个玻璃心。那不用了。If not, can we start with our meeting by the introduction? I'm Ellen Prince, and I am the chairperson of this select committee of public enterprises. And I'm going to give over to the honorable members to introduce themselves.
Good morning, all. My name is Omi Singh, member of this committee. I represent the province of KwaZulu-Natal, far warmer than where we are now.
My name is Bekumzo Charles Tofile, representing SALGA.
Good morning, Jacques Julius, permanent delegate from Gauteng in the select committee.
My name is Musawenkosi Mlambo from Gauteng, a member of the committee.
Can we move over to the...
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Balo Manilal. I am the CEO of the Technology Innovation Agency.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Grappe. I'm with the Technology Innovation Agency. I'm head of corporate relations and strategic engagements.
Good morning. My name is Tigendra Naidu, and I am with the Technology Innovation Agency.
Good morning, honorable members. I am Kerry Fall. I am the acting DDG of Technology Innovation.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Nandi Patsipane, Assistant Director and Office of the Director General of Science and Technology.
Good morning, honorable members. The name is Sonwa Mokeke. I'm the acting Executive Manager for Parliamentary Affairs for SALGA.
Thank you. Now, we'll start
Thank you. Good morning, Ashka Power. I'm standing in for Lalisa PC, who is the permanent secretary of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Eric Boskati. I'm the Cornell advisor for the committee.
Morning, everyone. My name is Melana, researcher for the committee.
Morning, everyone. I'm Vaba Tumezuni, the executive secretary in the office of the chairperson.
Thank you very much. And once again, good morning, Mr. Bal.
I don't mean to waste time, but I think it's just to spare thought for Honorable Sifako, I believe is hospitalized, one of our members.
What must I do?
No, I'm just saying
I
spare
already
thought.
Said it. I don't know whether you listen. In the during the apology, I was saying he was admitted in the hospital, one of our members. His house, is it a flat or a house?
Burned down.
Luckily,
thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and to honorable members. I think this is an opening statement before we go into the presentation. It can be a bit difficult, I think, condensing an overview of an agency in a short space of time. But in terms of, strategically, in terms of from a TIA perspective, we seek, I think, for the purpose of this presentation, to look at how the agency can work closer with the state-owned companies, can work in a much more integrated way within the various agencies that fall under this portfolio committee as well. So I think we can have an open discussion later on, but the idea is to look at how the the various agencies, public enterprises, and communications can utilize the very specialized capacity and resource tools that we have. And very often, I think one of the areas that we struggle with is having this very integrated approach to innovation and technology development in the country, especially with public entities. We operate within a silo mentality, and we don't integrate as well as we should. Service delivery innovation is a big area for us to focus on, and we want to look at how the entities that fall under this committee can better utilize the services that we have, and also look at how we can share resources, both funding and non-funding. So I think contextually I'd like to just place that as an opening statement, Madam Chair. Okay. In terms of the presentation, you have copies of the presentation. It's quite an extensive presentation. I will skip a little of the detail in order to ensure that we are still within the time limits as well. We will touch briefly on the TIA mandate, the financial and non-financial interventions, some of our performance targets, highlights and achievements. And I think for me the important slides is at the end, I think, as you said, working with the SOEs, how do we get a better integration and the future of TIA, and look at how we can reorientate the way we do business in the country as well. It starts off with the mandate. So I think very, very, through an act of parliament, TIA was established to look at how we could take innovation, how do we take ideas from idea stage, provide the requisite support, take it to commercialization, and in that process, stimulate the market, create a better society, improve the quality of lives for the people of South Africa. That's ultimately the vision of the Technology Innovation Agency. The mission is to facilitate the translation of South Africa's knowledge resource pool into sustainable economic opportunities. We operate in that value chain from the idea until we have an outcome for socioeconomic gain in the country as well. In terms of how do we do it, what is our promise, we look at innovating tomorrow together. And I think the important aspect, which I covered in the opening statement, was how do we get better at the together statement? How do we work closer with the various government agencies, government departments, and in this instance, I think particularly the SOEs, which we really struggle with at this point in time. If you had to then break down the mandate and highlight a few key elements of our mandate, it is to promote the development and exploitation, and I think very important, in the public interest of discoveries, inventions, innovations, and improvements. It is to support the state, and I think the state is a collective of all the various government departments as well, to stimulate and intensify technology innovation, to improve economic growth, quality of life, and to ensure that we can exploit the knowledge base that we have in this country as well. I know within the SOEs there are several challenges as well, and to be honest, I think if you look at the network that the technology innovation has, we have not exploited that to the benefit of these various agencies as well. So essentially our value proposition is to connect within the national system of innovation, to facilitate and broker, to be an active funder, and to enable the system. And unfortunately, I think we're working at the moment in a very fragmented landscape. We talk about the national system of innovation. It is national. There is innovation, but it's not quite a system. A system is interdependencies, and I think working in harmony with each other, which is an area that we need to focus on to get the ultimate and optimal benefits as well. If you look at the category of our funding instruments, essentially there's three categories of funding instruments. It is the Technology Development Fund, a Commercialization Fund, and I think importantly a Seed Fund. The Seed Fund operates at very, very early stage interventions and projects. The Technology Development and the Commercial Fund takes it right up to almost commercialization. Now what TIA does as far as its suite of services is our support tends to stop at pre-commercialization, because we believe once a product, once an idea has market applicability, market forces should carry it through as well. If not, then we're operating as a commercial bank. So we look at this value of debt in terms of ideas not having the requisite support to take it up to pre-commercialization. But once it has traction, once there is market application, the idea is market forces need to take it through. So if we look at the seed fund, very important, the seed fund has two components. One is the HEI, Higher Education Institute, support mechanisms, and the other is to fund SMMEs. The seed fund at HEIs, we operate at all the universities in the country. The SMMEs, we deploy those programs through the various regional development agencies. Both the HEI seed fund, we have a national footprint, and so does the SMME seed fund as well. The Technology Development Fund is to assist innovators to advance technologies along the innovation value chain from proof of concept to demonstration phase. The fund is designed to make early stage technology development more attractive and less risky to the market. So what we do is we take government resources, both funding and non-funding, to de-risk projects, to look at how we can handhold and support it and take it through the various stages to commercialization. What this essentially means is we operate in a very high-risk environment. So a lot of our projects have the potential and probability of failure. It is the way science operates. So we look at how we de-risk these projects, how we look at providing the requisite support to take them to the market. So we have quite a number of failures along the way, but that's the nature of science as well. The commercialization fund support is to prepare innovations for follow-on funding, to look at how then we can get these projects ready so that they could go to the IDC, the NEF, the DBSA, and even to the commercial banks for scale-up and full commercialization. We also have a lot of interventions within our innovation enabling programs, and that's looking at the total ecosystem. It's looking at the technology innovation programs, which is looking at the clusters, and the clusters essentially focus on how do we look at creating new industries? So we look at electric vehicles, we look at animal health, we look at energy, we look at pharmaceuticals, we look at medical devices and so on and so forth. And we look at how do we then take an entire cluster, provide the support so new sectors can emerge. This will tell you that we need to then work very closely with the DTI, Department of Economic Development, both at national and even the provincial equivalent agencies as well. The Technology Stations program is at the various universities of technology in the country aimed at enabling these to provide solutions to SMEs within the various industrial sectors as well. Technology platforms, these are very high-end research facilities that facilitate access to the private sector. We have 10 of these across the country, largely focusing on the bioeconomy areas. A cross-cutting initiative is our Youth Technology Innovation Program, looking at how we can reduce the barriers of entry for youth, look at how we can provide them quick, easy funding, and the requisite support so we can get more youth into the innovation value chain as well. Innovation skills development is also a cross-cutting intervention that looks at how do we look at the entire pipeline, how do we look at people in schools, people in universities, people in the market, and how do we create capacity development programs to bring them into the national system of innovation, give them the requisite skills, both local standards as well as international. So we have partnerships with various European countries. I think most notably we have a partnership with Silicon Valley and Stanford University, where we take a number of these young innovators and teach them world-class applications around developing their technologies as well. Very high level in terms of our performance targets. I think what's important to note as well is the agency structures itself as a high performance entity. In saying that, whenever we come up with targets, we look at stretch targets. So I think this is just an indicative slide in terms of our MTF targets. You'll see for 17-18 of the various strategic objectives, what the original target is and what the revised stretch performance target is. So the targets, and I wouldn't go through everything, I'll just take you through a couple of them. Number of technologies, processes, or services advancing by two or more technology readiness levels. The technology readiness levels is an NASA scale from 1 to 9, where 3 to 8, is the area that TIA operates at as well. Number of innovation products taken up in the market, amount of funding we can leverage from private sector, number of amount of income received, and I think it's important to note the income that we do receive is redeployed into our programs. I think strategic objective 2, you see the 5 KPIs there. Innovation products produced as a result of TIA funding support programs. Number of SMMEs supported, I think you can see 2,800 SMMEs per annum in the 17-18. Next year we plan to support 3,300 SMMEs within innovation and technology development. Thought leadership is also an area of focus for us to look at how we can ensure that we have a more positive mindset around innovation, around risk-taking, around technology development. How do we ensure we can get more of the youth involved in innovation and become entrepreneurs and forge SMMEs to ensure that we can uplift the economy as well? Madam Chair, I wouldn't go through all the MTF targets unless there are specific questions later on. But I think it just gives you a sense in terms of the entire organization and how it deploys its mandates and how it is measured. I think it's important to note that from a performance point of view, we strive to achieve minimum 85% of target achievement every year. Last year we achieved 91% of our targets. This year it was 86%, and we're looking at the 17-18, we're looking at having in excess of 91% target achieved as well. In terms of our income over the MTF period, you can see our budgets are not, Madam Chair, as big as perhaps the budgets your committee generally has a look at. Our MTF budget for 17-18, just under 400 million. We raise a further 151 million through investment yields, interest, etc. I think it's important to note that not a single cent from that 151 million goes into our operational cost. All of that gets redeployed into disbursements, into our support instruments as well. And you can see the 18-19, 19-20 is just inflation-based growth. What is also very important for this committee to note is the bottom figure, that's 27.6%, 27. So what we do as a corporate target is we make sure that of our total budget, 30% is used for administration, 70% goes through our direct instruments. So we make sure we don't have a situation where the entity is very inefficient. I think when that ratio goes up, if it's 50-50, then it starts bringing in inefficiencies as well. So we ensure that the bulk of our budgets go through deployment and servicing the core mandate. I did cover our annual performance for the past 4 years. You can see 15, 16, and it shows a progressive improvement year on year as well. Furthermore, in terms of achievements, in terms of numbers, millions attracted in TIA's portfolio from third-party funders. You can see 97, 200 million in 14, 15, and 74. The 200 million in 14, 15 was a bit of a windfall where we exited a number of our investments. That was not a normal trend, but generally it is between 80 to 100 million that we attract. Our disbursements, as you can see, 350, 371, 378. Very important, SMMEs receiving support. You can see that number growing year on year. It's 2,800 for the current year. For the next financial year, we're looking at 3,300 SMMEs supported. I think if you look at all the indicators, Madam Chair, you can see they are progressively growing, and I think those are based on the stretch targets that we have. Very high level in terms of commercialized technologies. We have a few, but I'm not going to go into the detail unless certain members have a particular interest in some of them. but they vary within the bioeconomy, in advanced manufacturing, natural resources, as well as ICT as well. Very important for the agency is our youth programs. We target 18 years to 35 to develop innovative solutions. We've invested over $40 million in the last 4 years. This is one of the problem areas that we have in terms of demand versus the resources we have, and we're looking at significantly expanding on the numbers as well. Supporting women, also a very, very important element for us. There's a number of women entrepreneurs that we support. Here again, the idea is to look at how we can expand on that to become more effective. In terms of our economic impact assessment, it's important to note that every year we have an independent economic assessment done for the agency. If you look, Madam Chair, from the year TIA was established in 2010, for the five-year period, 2010 to 2015, we did an independent economic assessment, and I think the important number there is the production multiplier of 2.87. What this simply means is for every 1 rand invested in TIA, we create 2.8 rands worth of value in the economy. And the idea is to look at how we can take that to 3 rand and beyond. So I think any investment into our programs from a government perspective is a very good investment to this country as well. If you look at the organization and its strategic evolution, TIA was established through an amalgamation of 7 agencies from the Department of Science and Technology. These 7 agencies came to being under TIA in 2009. But since 2009, the organization has had various challenges in terms of organizational restructuring, etc. And in 2015, I think for the first time, we've had organizational stability. So if you look at the strategic evolution, it shows the year 17 to 20, it's about strategic definition. 2023, it's about reorientating the organization within the national system of innovation. 2025 is really playing a strategic implementation role. And we say that it means really driving and coordinating the NSI in the country as well. If you look at our operational impetus for 17-18, we've classified it in 3 pillars. One is scale, is how do we upscale everything that we do? Pace, how do we become agile? How do we fast track, become as efficient without compromising governance? Space, that is, how do we deepen our programs? How do we allow greater expression of our programs? How do we bring in more SMMEs and entrepreneurs and accommodate them and restructure our programs to accommodate the NSI versus the NSI accepting whatever we structure ourselves internally as well? The strategic evolution, I'm not going to cover, spend time on that. It's just a summary of what I've just said. But I think important, Madam Chair, is our work with the SOEs. I started off stating that it's not what it should be. I've started off saying, to be honest, I don't know how we're going to have a more integrated relationship with the SOEs, but TIA certainly has the capability, the instruments to provide that support. And we will be looking at within our DST programs to look at how we can facilitate better cooperation to ensure that we can exploit the resources and capabilities that we have. Some of the projects we've had, just to give you a sense, for instance, is a program we're working with ESCOM. I know you're meeting ESCOM. It's a diagnostic multicam. It's a world-class technology for monitoring potential power line failure from corona discharge. An important tool in the utilities, preventative maintenance capabilities that enables rapid detection and quantification. So you don't need helicopters, etc., to do that. This device can quite easily detect damage to the power lines. The camera will be produced by a high-tech spin-off company. We're working with ESCOM as well as the CSIR on that. But there's various other interventions that we can do as well. A further program with ESCOM, it's a program that's WorldCore. It's a process that involves the removal of cylindrical metallurgical samples from the sidewalls. That's to repair the studs that gets used in the drilling processes. A new sampling and repairs process for high-pressure steam lines in the power generation industry. We're working quite closely with the Nelson Mandela University. It is funded by TIA as well as the ESCOM Innovation Fund. And we've over 12 years, there's a cost of 43 million rand being expended on that. This is seen by the power generation industry worldwide as the future new standard as well. So what it does is it's largely around looking at how we can reduce failures, how we can reduce plant downtime and increase infrastructure lifespan. We can do a full demonstration, and it will be, if this committee wants, it will be really, really great to actually show you the product and what it's capable of as well. So these are just two, I think, significant projects for ESCOM, but we should be doing 20. Promoting innovation in the aviation industry, we have a relationship with the air traffic navigation systems, various interventions there. We run a joint awards program annually, but also, Yaron, I think a lot more that can be done within advanced manufacturing, within aerospace and aviation, and I think in this instance within SAA. A further program that we have that has application within ESCOM is BioDX. This is a mild organic biocide tailored for application in agriculture, food, beverage, health, industrial industries. It's based on natural citrus extract. The products are biological and eliminates bacteria with a 99% kill rate as well. So what it does is, within all your cooling towers, etc., at ESCOM, this is the most effective way to ensure that you can eliminate bacteria, and that's a huge problem within the processing at ESCOM as well. We are working with them, but the idea is a lot more can be done. Innovation enabling for SOEs. There's some work around recapitalization of the power plants with third-party testing and verification of samples with Transnet, training of master artisans. Sorry for that. It's not fooling. It's tooling and foundry technologies. Petro SA, development of new curriculum for chemical process technology. So this capacity building at ESCOM, Transnet, and Petro SA. Looking for future collaboration, I think if you take an extract from the budget speech of the Minister of Communications, he was very clear in terms of South Africa as a country to be a significant player in the global technology development or to be a recipient and consumer who tails behind. So we have the two conundrums in terms of do we lead or do we follow. I think if we lead, then a lot more investment needs to go into research and development, technology development as well. Follower is easy. We become a manufacturing base, which is not what we want. The idea is to look at how we can transition South Africa from a resource-based economy to a knowledge-based economy. But that is a 20, 30, 50-year plan. But we need to start now and invest significantly in tapping into the knowledge base in this country, creating the requisite infrastructure and support mechanisms so that a lot more of the ideas can be taken to market. I think also very important to note, there is no shortage of smart people in this country. There's no shortage of smart ideas. We struggle in terms of providing them the support to take those ideas to market. Important, and I think, Madam Chair, this is what I started off giving a context. Government spends 12 billion in science technology initiatives in the country for 2014-15, and I think if you look at as it goes, so there's a lot of money in the system. The problem we have is it's not smart money. We are not harnessing, we're not finding synergies, we are not looking at how we can optimize and get the linkages working. So these repositories sit in various government entities, but they are not being harvested as they should. And we have an intervention that focuses on that, which is what we call the hub and spoke model. Now, I think this is very important, and it's almost a plea from me to this committee is to say, How do we get a situation where the various national government departments start using the capacity within the Technology Innovation Agency to advance their ambitions around technology development and innovation? We have the capacity, we have the network, we have the specialists, but not enough government entities and state-owned companies are coming in and knocking on our doors to say, help us solve our technology challenges in the country. Help us where we can come to a cost-sharing model to look at how we can provide support. So what the hub-and-spoke model aims to do, and I'll give you a visual slide, and that's, I think, the sum total of my presentation today, is to look at how TIA can play that central hub role, and at the end of the spokes is the various government departments and agencies, and how we can then coordinate this entire ecosystem to properly harmonize the full advantage of the infrastructure and the systems in place as well. But before we do that, what is important is this term we call the glass pipeline. Because I think this is all about visibility. And the big problem is, as the Technology Innovation Agency of South Africa, as the Department of Science and Technology, we don't know what the ambitions, aspirations are for all the government departments in this country around technology development. We don't have a good sense of what their challenges are. We don't have a good sense of where the agencies are and the state-owned entities are as far as advancing science and technology. Now, it's very important that all the actors in this ecosystem, in this value chain, have a good sense. Because what's important to note is that the Department of Science and Technology and its agencies is at the front end, where we take R&D and we convert it into application for commercial use. The DTI, DED, and the state-owned entities are actually the entities where they create the demand. So we have a source and there's a demand side. And at the moment, these two sides of this value chain are not talking to each other. So what we're advocating is, how do we have a glass pipeline approach? How do we ensure we can, as TIA, look at what the agency is, as an example, what does ESCOM need? Interface that with what is happening at the research institutes. How do we match these two and provide them the support and fast-track them through? And I think that's very, very important for us. And we need to ensure that we can have a culture and an openness to collaborate at this level. At the moment, we're not doing that. So the hub-and-spoke model, as I suggested, at the center of this hub is the Technology Innovation Agency. The various spokes are the government, national government departments, as well as the agencies, as well as state-owned enterprises. And we need to have full visibility to understand how we can collaborate and support, because the Technology Innovation Agency, to its acts in Parliament, has been empowered to drive the mandate of technology innovation in the country. And we can only do that through the support of these various entities as well. So TIA, to provide honest broker service to all national, provincial, local government entities with an innovation agenda, and how do we then do a cost recovery to ensure that we can drive these objectives. If you look at the NDP, unifies us in looking at innovation and technology development. So every national government department, provincial agency, provincial department, state-owned company are compelled because of the NDP to have innovation targets, technology room targets, but they are not smart targets and not well integrated into the entire system. So that's what we are saying. How do we work so that we can harmonize this entire system and use the Technology Innovation Agency to be the hub of that nationally? Madam Chair, I'll leave it to that. I rushed through the presentation to indulge your committee with the time, but I'll be very happy to answer questions. I will also really appeal to you that I get another further opportunity when your agenda allows us to take you through some field demonstrations to show you what we are doing and to look at how you can support us better so that we can support the state-owned companies and the various other national departments to really advance science, technology, and innovation in this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. CEO, I know it was a bit difficult for you to go through the document, but like I was saying, the time is against us today. but we will make a follow-up to invite you to get the details, and we look forward to seeing you at the demonstration, because it is very important. While you were presenting, allow me first of all going there to welcome the Honourable but also welcome the two Honourable Executive Mayors from Salva, who is present in our midst. Welcome to you, sir. Sorry that I didn't acknowledge your presence here, but yeah, welcome. I was thinking about a lot of issues that you can now both in the state-owned company that we are struggling. I was with the view that there is a working relationship kind of interdepartmental structure that is working on certain things. I know that you are doing some state-owned company things, mining, I remember, the chemical mining, environmental area and so forth. So I don't know how, if in cabinet they don't have that kind of discussions. I believe it is a place where you have to bring all those entities or departments together and have a view on how to move forward on these things. But like you were saying, we can play a role to make the entities aware for the importance to have you as partners to work on certain things. Especially I was thinking about, I think it's environmental or is it local government. We now, while we're having Salga people here, sitting with the problems, a lot of problems with dumping sites. What are you doing in that field to assist government to look at alternatives? And because the reality, the previous government, all those dumping sites is in the poor communities, and it's affecting us. At that time, maybe it was the best, the town planner that it was, but I mean, for now, it's not anymore suitable for us now in the new dispensation. So what are you doing in that field? Because it's a health problem, lot of problems we experience in that field. So we are over to the members. You are welcome to ask questions, Honourable Member. Can I get in? Honourable Julius, Honourable Nita.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question for clarity. The state-owned enterprises, how regular do you get requests from them? I'm not sure how it works. Do you decide for them, listen, you need this? How regular do they request help from you? There are various other bodies that's working on technology that's also in our department. How do you work hand in glove with them also? Let me just explain that, because there might be a confusion on your mandate and their mandate, because it looks on. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you very much, Chair. I hope my apology was attended.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. Chair, what I would like to know from the presenter, you have mentioned that you are having programs that are women and youth related, but you have not indicated to us where are they exactly. You would recall that we are representing provinces. It's important for us to know, so that when we have our programs, whether taking parliament or else oversight, we're able to touch and see those projects. And also, I would be interested to know how much are you allocating to those programs? And do you have maybe partnership either with municipality in the area or else with the department that is relevant, so that the sustainability in terms of the programs that you are doing there. And the other one, you mentioned that you feel uncomfortable the fact that you have a project that can deliver your smart money that you have referred to. But the problem with that, we are not using it in a way that can benefit the country. What I would like to know, what are your proposals? Because as NCOP, we are not only here to do oversight only, but as well we have a responsibility of helping you when there are bottlenecks. We become the institution that begin to facilitate to unblock those. And the other one, it's on the issue of glass pipe models that you have referred to, which you are also saying it has some bit of challenges. But what I would like to know, there is in the ministerial programs that are run at an NA level, I would like to know, is this one part of those that they get to be debated? And the rationale behind asking this question, we are planning to meet the having a workshop with interministerial units, whoever is convening it. So amongst the things that we would like to take into our project as NCOP would be this glass pipe model. And the other question is on the issue is products that you develop. What I would like to know from those products that you develop, do you have a percentage that comes back to you as a way of benefiting from the products that you produce? And pardon me on the last question that I'll be asking is on the issue of the audit outcome of the entity. I'd like to know I didn't go through your annual report and be able to see that. And the sustainability is critical for me. Thank you very much. Those are the questions.
Thank you, Honorable
Member.
Thank you. Anyone else? You asked a question on the provinces. I was thinking, perhaps you say you're working on ideas and whatnot, but are you guys going out to the various, you listen to the media things, the problems in state-owned companies, etc. Do you ever make like assessment or, you know, where you can play at home so that you can come up with a detailed, when you're meeting with those people, say, this is the area where we see us here, where we can play a role, and specifically in this area. Like people are saying, if you're coming to apply for things, you must do your homework, you must make must have a business plan, must have proper analysis of what you want to achieve and what you think you can do. I think that might help also with your idea, where you can say, okay, this is ESCOM, we as in our assessment, we think we can play a role here, and that's how we're going to work. I'm thinking about the mixed energy thing. There was different views on the energy, phoned me one day, they want to have a study group, but I told them it's not your call to call study groups, it's a politician's call, but they were saying, They want to come and present, they look for opportunity to come and share with us what is best for South Africa. Like I'm saying, that is the kind of way forward I would love to see, because then you can have real things that you can come with to the committee to say, we had this kind of assessment, we did it in Suffolk or whatever, and that is how we see we can play a role. Okay, thank you. See you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members for their questions as well. I'll try to answer efficiently, but just it's comprehensive enough. Madam Chair, in terms of your comments initially, and I'm very pleased, for instance, to have the two SALGA members. One of the things that we are trying to get off the ground is service delivery innovation. Now, very often, when we talk about innovation and technology development, we think Mark Shuttleworth, we think Elon Musk, we think about the big ideas that has international or global application. But there's also merit in looking at how do we take the smart ideas in South Africa and deploy it to resolve the problems that we are facing at a local level. And, you know, you can almost loosely term that almost like self-sustainability in terms of using the smarts to improve service delivery. So one of the ideas is to look at, and we've got Mr. Patrick Krupp here who will engage with SALGA going forward to ensure how can we intercept the discourse within SALGA to say how does the various instruments we have support service delivery innovation within the various metros. So we will pick that up, Madam Chair, as well. Another area that we are concerned and we're looking at advancing is social innovation. This is at grassroots level as well. How do we look at townships? How do we look at rural areas? How do we look at innovation that might not be even for market application, but just to uplift a community, where we give small amounts of money to ensure that there can be efficient ways to move water, sanitation, and the like, where the local people have the ideas, but they can't advance it. So we're focusing on that, which takes you out of the traditional way of thinking about innovation, which generally says, come up with an idea, sell it abroad, make millions. This is about how do we improve the lives of people in this country. The low entry level, and I'll confess that we're not doing enough as far as that is concerned, and the idea is refocusing the agency to ensure that we can become more effective on that. We have also, Madam Chair, engaged with the CPSI, Center for Public Service Innovation, to look at how we can work more closer with them, and that's an ongoing discussion. We haven't achieved much, but I think we need to just ensure that we can ramp up our initiatives there. In terms of, Madam Chair, your comments around waste, I think it's an important question. A new program that we have is looking at a cluster approach through waste beneficiation. We're working with the Department of Environmental Affairs as well as the Vaal University of Technology to look at creating various instruments, applications, support measures to advance waste beneficiation, because we believe that is feedstock that has a financial value, and very often it's becoming a problem in this country, and we need to just change the paradigm to say, how do we use it to bring about economic dividends for us? We also realize that waste beneficiation creates a lot of entry-level jobs, especially in the rural areas as well, and we look at how we can capitalize on that. More specifically, within waste beneficiation, we have a themed program on e-waste, that's electronic waste, to say how do we ensure that these old computers, old TVs, old smart devices are not ending up in the landfill sites, how do we recycle them and look at getting economic value out of that. So we are busy with that. We'd like to look at how we can upscale that with various other partners as well. Manager, your last question in terms of, you know, how does TI assess its landscape? Are we being cognizant of what's out in the discourse, and are we reacting? Yes, we are. Could we be doing more? Yes, we could. But I think we're also considerate of not being everything to everybody, and also being considerate to our resource. I think if you look at the 400 million, and if you look at what's required, we'd like this committee to assist us to expand that budget significantly. Mm-hmm. Our minister is a big ambassador to look at escalating TIA's budget to 1 billion rand within 5 years. So we have the competence, We have the processes, the systems, and the tools. My colleague K4 from NIPMO, they're at the coal face in terms of all the great initiatives that are coming out at the Technology Transfer Office and the IP that's sitting in this country. We're not deploying that and exploiting that as we should. But in order to do that, we need, I think, much, much bigger budgets. So we know what to do. We just need to capacitate these things a lot better as well. In terms of the members' comment around the state-owned companies and how regular do we engage with them, I started off initially saying not regularly enough. I think you've seen we've, to some degree, had some engagement with ESCOM. But what we need to do as a country is we need to start focusing on institutional arrangements versus the CEO and that CEO has a good relationship. Mr. Krapi knows his counterpart there, and when he leaves, that link's broken up. And that's what I said. The hub-and-spoke model is about institutional relationship, and we were even advocating what we called an innovation charter, led by our minister to ensure that all the other ministries signed that to say, as a country, we're going to pool all our resources. We're going to have one national program or alignment to say, how do we now open up and have porous boundaries between the various entities. So if you look at ESCOM, and I think the member is quite correct to say, all these entities, and I think if you look at ESCOM's R&D budget, it's bigger than TIA's budget a few fold. But their interventions are looking at their own internal applications. Their agenda is, how do we make ESCOM better? TIA is, how do we make South Africa better? And somewhere along that line, we must say, where do those two intentions converge, and how do we focus on that, and how do we ensure that ESCOM can, as an example, give TIA 50 million a year, TIA puts its 50 million and say, can we then open this a call to the community to come up with a better type of solar geyser or a better type of cost saving for energy? We don't do that. And that's where we need to get to. So that then we can go to our ministry and say, well, ESCOM is putting a billion. Can you give us a billion? So we have 2 billion rands in this country to really get the entire nation focusing on energy. And that's where we need to go if we're going to change this country. If not, we'll be doing piecemeal things in a completely disjointed manner. And I think that's what I mentioned about smart money and money that's not smart. There is enough money in the system. They don't have a good, happy relationship to bring about the synergies. And it can't be left to individual CEOs, and it needs to be institutionalized. We all work for South Africa. So every state-owned company, every national, we're not here running our private companies. And we need to start mobilizing in that manner. So to answer the member's question, we are not doing it as we should. We're not doing it in a way that's going to make a significant step change in this country. We're doing it really on a piecemeal basis, which is not how we're going to really change things over the next 20, 30 years. It's clear the NDP is telling us, transition us from a resource-based economy to a knowledge-based economy. That's a 40, 50-year program with everybody working together. I think the members' comments around women and youth, we do have the figures, Madam Chair, in terms of the amount of women and youth. I don't have it on my presentation, but I can tell you, we can send it through to you. We can even show you the geographic breakdown in terms of youth, women, etc. In terms of geographic breakdown, in terms of our investments, unfortunately, we have a polarity in terms of most of our investment support goes to Western Cape and Gauteng. That's where the bigger innovation ecosystems operate. What we are looking at is how do we now, I don't think you can ever have equity in terms of ensuring that all provinces, because they all are not at that level, is to also ensure that how do we operate so we don't overlook the value created in Limpopo, in Northern Cape, etc. And that's what we are busy working on at the moment as well. In terms of the hub and spoke, as I told you, that is what we're trying to do is The hub is, TIA has a national mandate. TIA has the networks, it has all the sister companies within the DST family. We are best positioned to harmonize and pull that together, focusing on innovation and technology development. We don't focus on everything. And we want to be the central repository to bring all this together. Ideally, we want to craft a national innovation strategy that spans 50 years that's going to transition us from this resource base to a knowledge-based economy. And in order to do that is to ensure that all the other national government provincial agencies fall in line with that. And that's why we're saying that can only happen on the back of some sort of charter that is supported politically and at government level. Madam Chair, the question around our audit results, I'm pleased to announce that we've had two clean audits in succession. The 16-17 financial year, the reason why I don't have it here is we got the official results end of May, so we also, our results in terms of the normal government timelines, our audits finish quicker than most other government agencies. For 16-17, we've got a clean audit with no matters of emphasis. In terms of our disbursements, 100% disbursements, no request for rollover. So I think we're ready to take on bigger responsibility. We're ready to deploy more funds. We've proven our credibility in terms of managing the funds efficiently as well. In terms of sustainability, we have largely, I mentioned the MTF funding. We also, and this ties into your next question around the return on investment and how do we capitalize on that. In addition to our MTF money, I did show you was additional income. So what we do on a number of projects, we give conditional grants. So an applicant comes to us with a great idea, we will give them 10, 15 million, and if they commercialize that, we have royalty payments that they give us as well. In certain strategic projects, strategic only, we will even take equity in a company. Now, the idea in government is not about acquisitions. We're not an acquisitions company. But we do that to de-risk, to ensure that we can properly get those companies into the market. And once they reach full financial sustainability, we will sell our shares and ensure that the country benefits from that as well. So we do, on very specific instances, take equity. But by and large, it's royalty payments based on the success factor of that intervention in the market. But in saying that, from the time you would support somebody till it goes into the market and becomes sustainable, sometimes it's 5, 6, up to 10 years as well. So there's a big lag in terms of when you invest and when you get royalty payments for that. But there is that, and we do get 20-30 million a year around the royalty payments as well. Madam Chair, that was the questions. If there's anything else, I'll be happy to answer them.
The last one is on the issue of international donor. I would like to know if you do have such.
Yes.
And more or less, which countries are they?
Madam Chair, we do, and that's, you've got the expert sitting here, but he'll give you a two-day overview with a lot of detail. So I'm going to give you a high-level summary. We do have international partnerships with the Swiss government, the French government, the British government, and we are aggressively pursuing other relationships as well to look at how we can tap into more donor funding. I think on the flip side of the discussion, in terms of where we get funds, in terms of international relations, let's talk about that. What we do is look at how we can support, firstly, our colleagues on the continent. So we have an advanced program looking at Africa relations, looking at how we can use the competencies and capacity we have in South Africa to lift our SADC countries. So we've engaged with Botswana and other entities, Namibia, to look at how we can copy and paste our programs and provide them the support. And it's our intention to play a leading and a catalyst role on the continent, first and foremost, to ensure that we can also lift them up and grow the economy at a continental. And the idea is to constantly look at how the Finnish government amongst us. I told you, Patrick will have a full comprehensive list, but we do look at donor funding. And the idea is to continually ensure that we can expand that network. UNIDO as well, ma'am. a very good relationship with them, United Nations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlos. It's always a pleasure to hear science and technology with us. So much that we can learn and it's very interesting. Thank you very much for your time and for the responses. We will invite you.
Thank you so much, yeah.
To a following meeting, and we must talk about the alignment of the intergovernmental working relationship with each other. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the esteemed committee. Thank you.
Can we just ask, because we need to adopt the report while we're here, can we just ask the honourable members to come in if they members are online? They must be present. You know, I saw one day, we went for over, I don't know where it was, over a kind of, I don't know if it's a, what is it, it's like a big truck, baby. The weight. What is it? It was coming, baby. Whether they want to reduce the single dumping size, and they are saying that this thing is working, you know, dumping is going into that truck, and then it is separating and do all the things. Hey, where are you going now? Whether I'm here or not, you're from Korra.
If you're here in Parliament or not in Parliament, we'll still go on.
You're not behaving very nicely before the people here. That's how they fight us as members of Parliament. Not taking our work seriously.
No, we're serious.
Yeah.
In two provinces? Okay.
Yeah, Chair. We are back. Yeah, we are back, and I move for the adoption.
No, it's just a cocktail.
Okay. I'm going to let them see what I can do. Hello, Mama.
Hello, Mama. Hello, Mama. Hello, Mama. Hello, Mama. Hello,
no, but it's done and that Eastern Cape must have gone after Northern Cape out.
So
what will help my stress to calm down? What can I say? Science and technology. Strong black coffee, no sugar, no milk. And you must blend some grass.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Special word of welcome to Eskom people. We were waiting for you. We thought that you will be here earlier than it starts. But anyway, thank you. But yeah, there is our fault. But welcome, and we are not going to do introduction. She wanted to. Yeah, let's do the introduction. You don't need. Is there not a need? Okay, sure. So there's no need for honorable Julius.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can we please have the introductions? And I don't mean to waste time,
but for
the board changes every week. So
okay. Okay, sure. Can we then start with the introduction? Everyone knows me. I'm Ellen Prince, and I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee of Public Enterprises. And I'm going to give over to the honorable members that they can introduce themselves. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Zukiso Mita. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Lennox Gaylor.
Good morning. Omi Singh.
Morning. Charles Begumza Stofile from SALGA.
Good morning. Ndagisang Koni, Northern Cape Province.
Good morning. Jacques Julius Gauteng.
Mosam Lambo from Gauteng.
Good morning, Makhola Makululu, Acting DDG Energy, DPE.
Anuj Singh, CFO, Eskom.
Dion Kunrori, Eskom.
Good morning, Caleb Kassam, Eskom.
Good morning, Abraham Asano, Group Executive, Eskom.
Good morning, Kulu Pasiwe, Eskom.
Good morning, Josie from Apumodo
Eskom.
Good morning, Sonabo Kaika from SALGA.
Thank you very much. I think I also want to welcome the two representatives of SALGA. They are only the chairman. They come and sit in at the meeting. Like everybody knows that all our meetings is open. Everyone
can come and think that I'm not going to take part in discussing how we are thinking. Can we proceed with the meeting and give over to you? I don't know who's going to take us through. Good morning, ma'am. Good morning, Chair and members. We are here to present on the ESCOM 2017-2018 tariff increase as requested by the committee. And firstly, I would just like to apologize from the acting chairperson of ESCOM, Mr. Zitembe Khoza. He was unfortunately not available to make the meeting given prior commitments, and that was as a result of the resignation of the previous chair, Mr. Dr. Benin Mubani, on Monday. So sincere apologies from him. He would have certainly liked to attend. In terms of the detail of the presentation, Dion and Caleb will take us through the details of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable members, you've received a pack. We've just included three additional slides to give better context in terms of just add to the understanding of the presentation. And as we move forward, I'll take you through that. First of all, I think it's important to understand the context. If we just take you through the last 5 year NERSA decisions, you can see it was 5.8%, but in year 3 and year 4 of the MIPD3, the increases were impacted by the RCA decision that actually NERSA allowed Eskom to recover more revenue during that specific years. But then you will see that in year 5, which is this year in contention, year 17-18, they again decided to keep it back to the original decision, with a 2.2% impact, which the implication is that Eskom has effectively seen just an 8% increase over the 5 years. So we're back to the original decision of NERSA 2030. The impact of the 2.2% municipal price from 1 July, the overall Eskom price increase is 2.2%. And municipalities, and I'll go into more detail later on, because of the Municipal Finance Management Act that determines that Eskom can only implement to municipalities on 1 July of every year, once they follow the statutory process, is 0.31%. That's been already tabled in Parliament on the 31st of March, and the information in the presentation is then specifically focused on the 2% increase. when you consider the Eskom tariff increases, it's important to understand also the regulatory environment that Eskom operates in. In terms of the Electricity Regulation Act, Eskom cannot just implement any increases. NERSA has to approve any increase, and Eskom is only allowed to implement any tariffs that has been approved by NERSA. We also sit in a situation that we're not only supplying to our own customers. Our financial year runs from 1 April to 31st of March, so we implement the 2.2% to our municipalities to our direct customers on 1 April, but in terms of the Municipal Finance Management Act, we are forced to only implement increases once we've timeously tabled in Parliament. The others is the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, which is a quite important act that we need to comply with. There are judicial review and administrative action. There's the government electricity pricing policy that we adhere to. And then the codes, the grid code, the transmission and distribution code, that's all part of our license conditions. And then there are certain NERSA rules and guidelines. Eskom has followed the process, the compliant process, in terms of the MFMA for the municipal tariffs. There you can see the proof. That's a copy of the document that we received where it was minuted that Eskom has tabled the increases. It is said in the MFMA that we must table by 15 March, but again, it's important this year because there was at one stage NERSA said they want to we requested the Minister of Finance, because of timing issues, that we can get an extension, and the Minister of Finance provided an extension until the 5th of April to submit to table in Parliament. But we have tabled in Parliament on the 31st of March. This is just an explanation of how the battle we sit with in terms of the MFMA, where we can only implement on 1 July. The Eskom customers see the full 2.2% increase over that financial year. Eskom must recover also a 2.2% increase from municipalities, but as a result of the MFMA, municipalities continue to see the previous year's prices for the first 3 months of our financial year, that is from April to June, and thereafter we can only recover the remainder of the revenue that we are allowed by NERSA to recover. And this time around it was very lower because it comes from quite dark from a high percentage base the previous times. The next slide is actually the result of the decision by NERSA and following their methodologies. And you can see there that all the Eskom direct customers just see the 2.2% increase, but because municipalities only see increase from 1 July, they will only see an increase on their Eskom purchases from Eskom of 0.31%. The implications of that is, we've already said, Eskom has received a 2.2% increase. In terms of, again, agreements that we have, and Eskom has to purchase the electricity from IPPs, and so therefore the increase to IPPs has to be passed through, and that already takes up 1% of the 2.2%, leaving Eskom with only about a 1.1% increase for the remainder of our own, actually for our own business. We have the 45,000 megawatt installed capacity. There's always a question around affordability. And I just want to, again, just re-emphasize that that for Eskom, the affordability for the poor is a very important issue. But it must also be, again, just the context of that is that Eskom supplies only directly to 40% of customers in South Africa, while 60% of the number of customers are supplied by municipalities. So in protecting the poor, it's important that we have a joint responsibility between municipalities and Eskom to address the affordability for the poor. What has been done in the past, we also work very closely with government, and as you can see, the first one, government is providing funding for access to electricity networks through the National Electrification Program, and in Eskom, for the home line 20 amp tariffs, I know it's a number, but just it's our lifeline tariff, that is our tariff to the poor, they don't pay any connection charges in addition to the grant that they get from government from a capital perspective. We've provided lower tariff entries for specifically the lifeline tariff in previous years, before there were other important projects brought in. Government has also brought in the 50 kilowatt hour per household free basic electricity. Eskom does not do it. We are only agents of municipalities, and I can just confirm that if we get the list from municipalities, we do apply the 50 kilowatt hour free basic electricity to the customers that's been identified by municipalities. When we had the major load efficiency drive, we provided this much lower usage lights to the customers, and then NERSA implemented inclining block tariffs back. In addition, in MYPD 3, NERSA has made the decision that for Eskom's home light, the lifeline tariff for the block 1 tariff part, which is the lifeline the poor customers, sees a 2.4% less of an increase than the average increase, and for the block 2, it's a 0.4% less. So just in conclusion, the tariff that's been approved by NERSA has been, the municipality part of it, has been tabled before implementation as per the MFMA requirements. Eskom will continue to collaborate with stakeholders across South Africa, and we will continue to engage in discussions around tariff frameworks. Municipal business is a key component in Eskom revenues, and therefore we will proactively work together to address any issues as well as the current outstanding debt that we experience from municipalities. And then we just want to confirm that affordability, as you've seen, we've done, is also important to Eskom in this process. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. That is the presentation. A very short one. Thank you very much. And I just make sure Salga can ask questions. They cannot vote. Thank you very much. But you know, nowadays you have to make sure, because people is taking you to court if you're not following the right procedures. And for me, I didn't know, that's why I make sure. At least I didn't make a ruling you're not allowed. I said we must go make sure, because I don't want to take away the data from you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can we have hands for questions on the report, please? Not single on the report, please. Raise your hands on the report. Thank you very much. Can I have hands? Let me... yeah.
I don't see from my side, I just want to understand, you know, the procedural thing. We are not so up to date with it. NERSA, did they approve these tariffs? And the cycle of the parliamentary cycle, did NA dealt with this thing? And I just want to understand it, because I don't want to have difficulties
by doing things and not, you know, procedural in most times. So I just want to have clarity on that one. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I'm taking advantage that Salga is present in a meeting. Sometimes you hear these things outside the meeting. Now we are in a formal setting. Some of these things must be clear so that all of us read from the same page. I know that there is an accusation from the Salga or else municipality side, let me not say Salga, that you do not want to recognize Salga recognize them as an executive authority in respect of the right to executive on the right to administer the whole thing of regulation of the electricity. So I would like to know from you now in this meeting, where do you stand in terms of that? So that when we go back to municipality and we get to be confronted on those questions, we are able to say, this is what ESCOM is saying in the presence of Salga. If there is distortion in terms of anything, Salga is part of the meeting. They will be able to clarify the stage of the municipality as they represent the municipality. That is the first question that I would like to ask. I'll come back, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Honorable.
Chairperson, can I give the Salga rep first?
You proceed? Awesome. Thank you. You're not sharing. You cannot come and tell me who I must ask you.
I'm requesting that while I'm busy, that he goes first.
Okay, Mr. Gaila, can you proceed? I have a reason why I'm saying this. No, you can go.
The 2.2%. Is that the final increment that we are expecting?
Final increment?
Yeah. Is that the final increment, the 2.2%?
Thank you. Can we go to Salga? Sorry. I think you're done. No, it's fine. You can proceed. I thought you said. Okay. Honorable Salga.
Thank you, Chair Stofila. From Salga. The presenter from ESCOM spoke about process. And that process, it also includes submissions. I'm saying, Chair, thank you very much. I'm saying the presenter from ESCOM spoke about process, and process also includes submissions. Salga have written submission and we are waiting for them to reply, and in the presentation I don't hear them reflecting on that. And what might be the reason? Is there any reason for that? The second thing, Chair, is that we acknowledge, and that is why in the interministerial committee there was an acknowledgement that over a period of time ESCOM has not been acting faithfully in the processes because of the different financial years. The question therefore on that issue is
they are talking about increase on 2%, which impacts on member municipalities to SALGA. And what process did they follow to engage SALGA and all relevant parties in that process? Because the increase is not necessarily going to impact to municipality alone, is also going to impact to customers of municipalities, because that increase had to have your mock-up and everything. So generally, I need to know what processes that they followed insofar as engaging that item is concerned. Because as we stand as SALGA, we are still waiting for ESCOM to reply to what we have written to them as submission, as requirement.
Thank you. Honourable, please.
Thank you, Professor. Can you please elaborate on the municipal debt to ESCOM? How severe is it? How much is it? And are you getting the money from municipalities? Second issue, how far are you with the Soweto prepaid meters? Because that also impact on your income, you know, determining your increase. And then the Supreme Court of Appeal last week NERSA lost the appeal based on last year's increased tariffs and so forth. So what's the impact of ESCOM on ESCOM of this appeal or the judgment of the Supreme Court of Appeal? Your RCA, the regulatory clearing account, I just want to ask a question on prudency, because it's looking backwards every year, you know, and looking at prudency from ESCOM's side. In terms of prudency and this 2.2 increase, how is it justified? Can you actually explain with that also your multi-year price method, where we have to provide smooth and predictable price path for customers to plan ahead. That's one of the regulatory frameworks that you have to apply. How did you determine that? I just need to get to the point where we say, is it always necessary for an increase? Because look, in terms of your RCA, you can also give back to customers if you don't need an increase. What justifies your increase, actually? How do you determine that based on, I think there are eight, I can't recall it now, Chairperson, I think there are eight methods that they use in the RCA in terms of determining your increase. And then they can, you know, step in and give you, I think they gave you 200 and something billion last year to fill the gap based on the increase, you know, the gap that had to be filled due to you not getting the increase that you wanted. Can you just explain to me that? Will you need it again this year? Because it says also here in your document that, sorry, Chairperson, for the, but this one is a bit, but it says it has ended in 2018. I just need to make sure, is it correct on slide 6 in your presentation? The first bullet there, NERSA's revenue decisions for the 5-year period has come to an end on 31st of March 2018. Can you just explain to me, you know, it has come to an end. So it will come to an end actually in 2018. That is what I understand from it. So in actual fact, we are still within that. This actually, we are still in that period. So how does it impact the 2.2%? Will you need more money? And, you know, based on the RCA, how much will you need to fill the gap in your approved increase? I'm not sure whether you get me. Okay, no, I'm happy for that. And then also, you used a lot of diesel in your open cycle gas turbines, and that actually increased the cost of the operation cost of Eskom a lot. Are you still using it? Will you still be using it? Is it not necessary? Did you actually plan for these things not to happen in future? Because, you know, with that also comes a lot of challenges. You know, apart from, you know, I'm sure, Chairperson, you said that we should only stick to the presentation, but there are other things that actually has a bearing on the increase of tariffs. Now, I'm almost done. Just one more point, Chairperson. Challenges in management of Eskom is still a huge problem. We have, for instance, this case where I think it was 2014-15, where we had this huge fraud case about, you know, we increase because we must buy this diesel to keep the lights on. And the diesel will be the last instance, you know, to keep the lights on. But yet again, when buying this diesel, a dentist and a beautician without BE credentials or BE compliance certificates got these contracts. Eskom bought it for much more than it was actually the right price. You know, these cost-saving measures, you know, can we do away with them? How do we? Because if you ask for an increase, you need to also tell us, how am I saving money for Eskom? How am I making sure that these things do not occur in Eskom? You know, think of it, Eskom money is Eskom money, Chairperson. 30 million handshakes. It's bearing on the cost of Eskom, and who must pay? The poor consumer out there must bear the brunt of reckless decisions in Eskom. You know, and thank you, Chair. I'll just stop there.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Nita, and then Honourable Kayla.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, in your page 6 of your presentation, there's a mention of affordable electricity for poor, if I'm quoting you clear. But what I would like to know, how are you going to make sure that is happening? The reason behind my question is the fact that there is a claim that in some municipalities, they do not have a credible indigent register. So that one, it is a problem, Chair. And I would like to know, in the presence of the SALGA delegation, what are they proposing to the NCOP to do to help them with other departments that can be of help? If you talk your social development, your Department of Home Affairs, for the credibility of the indigent. Because as we talk the 2.2 increase, obviously it is going to impact to the poor. And if you are unable to exactly identify who are those poor communities that we are referring to that can get the affordable electricity, it will be problematic and won't be able to achieve what you want to in terms of your page 6. And again, Chair, some municipalities, Chair, are complaining that Eskom is supplying electricity in their areas of jurisdiction without a proper service level agreement. And if you know, if that is true, you would say that you are encroaching to municipal jurisdiction, which is unlawful for you to do that. If that is true, when are you planning to resolve the issue? We really need to have time frames on that, because it has serious implications to the municipality. And on the issue of debt that is owed by municipalities, I'm sure by now you have the list of those municipalities, and you have engagements that you have done with the municipalities themselves as well, with their association, with SALGA. Well, how are you planning to resolve the problem? Because again, on that one, you'll have a situation where we said we no longer have load sharing as a country. Yet again, you have municipalities that do not have electricity. You have cut off electricity because they no longer paying. You know, that on its own, it impacts negatively, Chair, to the growing of the economy of that particular region, if it's a region, or else a locality. Because the investors that are there will definitely pack their bags and go, because electricity is one of their basic needs. So in this issue, we need to be really calm and come up with a clear plan that is workable. Because municipalities themselves, they complain that this thing is also because of some departments at a provincial level, at a national level, that are not paying. And also the issue of affordability by municipalities themselves. So as government that is having IGR structures that are sitting, how is your department helping the entity to make sure that the matter is resolved amicably and there are no cutting of electricity which will result to serious problems? Because in some municipalities they also have clinics that are using electricity, babies are delivered there, they've got hospitals that are there. You know, you see the impact of not having electricity. It goes to a number of things. So which means we need really to hear from you the plan moving forward in terms of dealing with the matter. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
On the point that Honourable Mita does not extend on that.
Right. Chair, in regards to the electricity debt that the municipalities have with Eskom, has Eskom got an agreement with the municipality that money is paid in by customers in a municipality, every one of the customers are not a default? Like Honourable Nita said, that businesses are also affected by this, by the municipality not paying and they've been cut off. Have we got an agreement with municipalities that where customers are paying, that money should be paid to Eskom, and not all residents or all clients in that municipality should be deprived of electricity, because municipalities use the money that has been paid by some of the customers for other items the municipality has problems with. So I think that we need to look at that as well and not use monies that have been paid by customers for electricity, and they are being victimized because the municipality is not managing their money as well.
Thank you, Honorable Gaylor.
Yeah, the two colleagues here have more or less covered me. But in your slide 7, one is interested to know the assistance to customer to implement energy efficiency, such as better insulation at homes. Is that working? And can you say to this committee now that all our customers are aware of that, because it's very important? Is it working, and how do you inform the customer that there is this type of assistance that you have? And lastly, in addition to what I was asking, a 2.2% increment. Are you now saying to us here, yeah, you're only going to have 2.2%, which then means that if I buy electricity for 200 rand, I'll pay 204.40. Will the end of the line customer get will it be 2.2% on the end of the line customer? Can you confirm that to us so that we know that it's only 2.2%, and it's a pity that now Salga is not sitting on that side. We would have asked them as well, but unfortunately it's not their meeting. If will they also pass 2.2% on the customer as well, you know, it's very important. It's very important so that you don't agree on 2.2% in municipalities. Charge us more. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's a pity that Salga is sitting on the other side. Yeah, I think those are the two. So
I'm going to give you the advice.
Sorry, man, I'm still fresh from the municipality. You understand my case. The last one from me. Is the issue of standard charge for street lights. You know, that thing is impacting very negatively to our communities, especially now we've got very high rates of violence against women and children. Our streets are dark because there's this thing between your municipalities and ESCOM on the issue of standardizing the street light charge. So can you give us clarity on that? Because I really fought with the municipality. All our areas are attacked. They are saying they can't afford because there's this thing that is between you two. Can you help us and give us direction on that and tell us where can we help you in terms of making sure that you resolve the matter for the safety of our community? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think I need to ask also one last question for us to understand while Saga is here, so that we can understand, is there a one size fits all in the matter of electricity to the clients in the municipality? I mean, I'm talking about what I see on my bill, and I can get my bill, I can show you. In Oxford, where I said, the increases on electricity, you were saying there is a NERSA to regulate. But why is it that they can ask 7, 10, or 11%? You know, in some cases, 15.5%. So explain to me, that's what I want to understand. Because why can we not, in Cape Town, I know they have like a freight car, what you call it. Yeah. So why is it that municipalities can do as they please by increase? And what, that's why I'm asking, is there a person that regulates the municipalities?
Honourable members now, I think we need to respect others. Honourable Nita, when other people is sharing, they call you quickly too if you just say hello. So we must really respect each other. People is watching our things also. So they can observe when there is people who say, who's not respecting each other. So come, I'm not saying you are in a school, but keep it, respect us while we are on the floor. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair and members, for all the questions. If we can take each one of them in turn, I will pass them along in terms of the respective people to be able to answer. In terms of the approval of the 2.2% by NERSA or not, Madam Chair, we can confirm that the 2.2% has been approved by NERSA. It formed part of the record of decision that they took as part of the electricity board. I think they have an electricity board that basically sits and takes a decision. So that was done, I think, at the end of February. And we were informed of that accordingly. In terms of tabling before Parliament and the National Assembly, I think that has been done, Madam Chair. On the authority relating to electricity reticulation, maybe we can ask Makola to respond to that one.
Thanks, Anoj. On the executive authority over municipalities, there's an interministerial committee that is chaired by the Minister of COCTA together with the Minister of Public Enterprises and the Minister of Finance that are dealing with the issues relating to municipalities. And there's an array of issues that we are dealing with. It arose as a result of the issues relating to municipal debt. But one of the arguments there that came about was the jurisdiction in terms of distribution of electricity. And a legal team has been set up to try and deal once and for all with the issues around who has jurisdiction over distribution. And there is strong arguments from both sides. We've made representation as a technical task team to the ministers, and that we still await the final outcome in terms of who has that authority, because the Constitution talks about municipalities having that jurisdiction. However, NERSA also has the prerogative to issue these licenses, and they have been issued to ESCOM in some of the areas. So then the issue around the service delivery agreement will arise out of the agreement on where does the legal jurisdiction lie between the two parties. So I think in the absence of resolving that issue, the issue of the service delivery agreement remains hanging. And I think we also need to talk about, in a scenario where municipalities do have the jurisdiction and we have to have the service delivery agreement, I mean, the social part of it, of customers having to understand that would result in other additional administrative costs that would then have to be levied against them in lieu of the service delivery agreement, sort of a management fee that would have to be paid to municipalities. So I think it's a legal process that would probably require some sort of adjudication or arbitration for us to come to a final decision. I think if members would recall from the time when we were trying to implement the white paper on energy and the issues around the REDS, where the REDS came from and why we never implemented that decision, it was exactly around the constitutional issues surrounding the authority of the distribution business. And that has never been resolved up until now.
Thank you, Makola. In terms of the question around the 2.2% and whether that is a final increase, Madam Chair, we can confirm that for the 2017-18 financial year, the 2.2% is indeed a final tariff increase. The only way ESCOM can increase its tariffs is through a NERSA determination. So there is no available opportunity for ESCOM to increase its tariff any other way, given the 2.2 that's already been tabled. And and while we're talking about the 2.2, in terms of the Honourable Member's question around the 200 Rand versus the 204 Rand, for ESCOM standard paying tariff customers, that should be the case and will be the case in terms of the application of the 2.2% increase. Madam Chair, let me move on to the questions around SALGA and our presentation not responding to the concerns that have been raised by SALGA. Madam Chair, we are not under any obligation to engage with SALGA as it relates to the 2.2% tariff increase that has been implemented. There is no requirement for us to have done that. There is a requirement, however, when we submit a revised tariff application, like now we've done for the 18-19 financial year. Remember, we're talking about the 17-18 financial year. The 18-19 financial year, there is a revised tariff application or a new tariff application that has been submitted for 1 year. And any new tariff applications that are submitted, there is a requirement in terms of the MFMA for us to engage not only with SALGA, but also with National Treasury. And in compliance with the MFMA, we have engaged with SALGA, and we have engaged with National Treasury associated with that application. We are then required by the MFMA to consider the comments that we then receive from both National Treasury and SALGA and incorporate to the extent we believe necessary those considerations in our tariff application, which then is submitted to NERSA for consideration. But again, Madam Chair, just for clarity, the comments that we have received from SALGA relate to the 18-19 tariff application, which is still with NERSA. They have not determined what that would be. The current discussions that we're having today is around the 17-18 tariff application, which relates to the 2.2%. The next question, Madam Chair, is the question around municipal debts. The municipal debts, as at the end of March, stands at around 9 to 10 billion. At the end of March 2017, there was quite a escalation of debt between March 2016 and September 2016. The debt, I think, at March 2016 stood at around 6 billion, and by September it had escalated to about 9 billion. The forecast for that 9 billion to escalate to 31 March 2017 was in the region of about 12 billion. When we saw the projection and the potential escalation of this debt, that is when we then engaged in terms of the implementation of the PAJA process to turn off municipalities. The process that then followed from there was that we invoked the PAJA process, we engaged with municipalities, we signed up 62 payment arrangements with municipalities, which enabled us, I think then we only turned off, I think, three or four municipalities. The rest of the 62 were not turned off, or the other 58 were not turned off, sorry. As of today, we have successfully mitigated the risk of that balance growing to 12 billion, because the balance is now sitting at around 9 billion. So we've contained the problem by entering into these, let's call it payment arrangements, and the threat of turning off municipalities in compliance with PAJA, because we can't just also just somewhat turn off the municipality. There's a long protracted process that needs to be followed before that happens. In terms of the current status of those payment arrangements, as I understand it, of the 62 that we've signed, 31 are relatively paying as part of those payment arrangements. So we will call the, let's call it other 31, relatively at this point delinquent on their payment arrangements. So half of the guys that have said that we will pay are currently paying. And the ones that are paying are not also up to date with the arrangements that they have, but at least they are paying. So again, I think we will find that there will be a threat that the 9 billion will start escalating, because the 32 municipalities are obviously not honoring that debt or the payment arrangements. So we'll obviously go through another cycle of PAJA and try and mitigate that exposure. Madam Chair, then there was another question around the Supreme Court of Appeal, that decision and that happened last week. To correct the Honourable Member, NERSA lost the initial court case that was brought against them. The Supreme Court of Appeal overturned the initial judgment. So actually it means that NERSA has won the case in the Supreme Court of Appeal, which means that it allows NERSA to now again adjudicate the revenue clearing account applications that ESCOM has submitted to NERSA. And for the benefit of the members, if the court case was not found in NERSA's favor, the RCA applications that were submitted would then have to be rejected by NERSA. So that was the implication. The next question that follows, Madam Chair, is again relating to the revenue clearing account and the RCA process. So when one of the questions that was asked is around prudency, is the 2.2% justified? When we look at a normal tariff adjustment like the 2.2%, there is no requirement for us to apply the concept of prudence in terms of the methodology. Secondly, ESCOM is not at liberty to decide on prudency because we are effectively the licensee. NERSA has to decide whether the costs we incur are actually incurred prudently or not. So it's an obligation on NERSA to perform that. If we had to answer that question, I think we can answer it quite simply by saying, if you look at any organization or any business would like to at least have an inflationary increase in tariffs to keep pace with inflation. Inflation in the country is currently around 5 to 6%. ESCOM has got a 2.2% tariff increase. So effectively, tariffs for the paying customer has actually grown by probably negative 4% year on year. In real terms, if you adjust for inflation. So on that basis, I think we could probably say that, listen, a 2.2% tariff increase is not unjustifiable in that circumstance. In terms of the other question around MYP, the multi-year price determination methodology, having to provide smooth and predictable and stable tariff paths, I think if you look at the first slide that we put up, you will see that the MYPD determination, which was a period which covered a period of 5 years, and maybe John, it'll be useful to put that up if you can find it. That covered a period of 5 years. You will see that the deviations from the 8% that NERSA had determined was relatively within reasonable band, because they determined 8%, and the maximum that we actually got in any one of those 5 years is 12.4%, I think it was. So it was a 4% deviation. And if you look at the cumulative increases that we had got as a result of the NERSA interventions, if you look there, there's the 12.69 and there's the 8. So basically it varied by 4% in that 1 year, and then 1.4% in that 1 year, and then it went down by, let's call it, 7% to 2.2%. If you add up that 8, 8, 8, 12, 9.4, and 2.2, and you divide it by 5, you effectively get to about an 8% increase anyway over the 5-year period. So by and large, the objective of an MYPD process is by and large to give you that trajectory that you can predict on. So we believe that the 8% that NERSA eventually allowed us and what we're actually getting through this process is relatively in line. Is it always an increase due to the revenue clearing account process? The honourable member is quite correct in that the revenue clearing account process works both ways. So in some years, depending on circumstances, ESCOM may be owed money where we'd have to collect that money from the customers, as it was the case in the 12.69 and the 9.4. But also equally, the reciprocal is also true, is that in some years, we may over-collect from the customers, which then we have to give back to the customers in the year thereafter. So it's a mechanism that actually works both ways. And if you, not to get bogged down in detail, but the reason why you actually have a 2.2 in year 5 is because we actually gave back some of the RCA that we actually collected in as part of the 9.4%. So it's already given back in that 2.2%. In terms of the comment around filling the gap, and ESCOM was given 200 billion, we were not given 200 billion. So just correction on the number. If you're talking about the 9.4%, we were given, 11 billion? 11 billion? Yeah, as an increase. So basically the increase that we got as part of the 9.4%, which was the RCA effect, was 11.4 billion or something. The full RCA application that we had submitted to get the 11.4 billion that we had, that NERSA had given us, I think was around 22 billion. So maybe that's where the 20 number came from. In terms of do we need it again this year? Unfortunately, okay, let me answer the question firstly. This year there's no RCS. Okay. So the 2.2 is the 2.2. So if you're then asking the question from a methodology perspective, unfortunately, the RCAs work on the basis that if you have a multi-year tariff determination, which is more than 1 year, because you are looking into the future and asking about future amounts and you are using assumptions about the future, to the extent the assumptions are different to reality in 3 years from now, an RCA will be created. So the RCA is basically, it reconciles your actual numbers to your forecasted numbers. So to the extent that there is always a deviation between what your expectation is and what reality is, you will have an RCA. So you will always have a tariff application, which determines what your tariff is, and then you will have an RCA, because that's how the methodology actually requires it to work. Confirm that MYPD3 ends in 2018. Indeed, sir, it does end in 2018. However, as you know, ESCOM cannot get a tariff increase without a formal tariff application to NERSA. Hence, we have now submitted the 18-19 tariff application to NERSA that enables us to have a tariff increase that can be implemented in the year 18-19, because this thing ends. Okay. The RCA application, sir, we have submitted to NERSA 3 RCA applications. They have adjudicated 1, which is the 9.4%. They have 2 other RCAs that are currently with them, and that is the 14-15 and 15-16 applications. Both of those applications are to the value of about 22 billion rand each. So there's about 44 billion in total on RCAs that are there with NASA currently. Madam Chair, then we needed to deal with the issue of diesel. And again, to give the Honourable Member some comfort, Madam Chair, yes, it is a well-known fact that diesel usage was at an unacceptably high level at some points in ESCOM's recent history. We have certainly arrested that situation quite significantly, Madam Chair. We were burning diesel at a rate of about a billion rand a month at one stage in ESCOM. Currently, I don't think the diesel bill for the entire financial year ended 31 March 2017, don't quote me on the number, I might not be correct on the number, but cannot be more than 250 million rand for the entire year. And that relates to not actually burning diesel for the production of energy, but it's a need for us to continuously, you know, move the diesel, use the diesel, and so on and so forth. Future plans associated with diesel, Madam Chair, we certainly don't have any plans to use diesel in the generation mix. We currently obviously have excess capacity from the current existing assets. In the unforeseen circumstances that we may have to use diesel, we will use it, but it's not in our plans to do so. Every energy utility does have or does need or does have a requirement to have a flexible energy mix. So you obviously need your base load power, you need renewable energy, and you need peaking plants, as we call them. And in the instance where we need to run diesel for peaking purposes at when there is a peak, sudden peak for electricity, maybe we'll use them. But in order to mitigate the risk of using very expensive energy alternatives, we are currently in the process of converting some of the diesel turbines into gas turbines. And I'm also informed by Mahola that some of the diesel expense that we actually incur as a result of the and we run the diesel on these is the DOE peakers. So some of the renewable IPP programs that we've been required to sign up from the Department of Energy REIPP program requires us to use them, and they use diesel. So that might be another source of where we would actually incur diesel expenses. Madam Chair, we also quite cognizant of the fact that we can't just continue increasing tariffs, and it was a valid point that was raised by the Honourable Member. as to what do we as ESCOM do on our own to promote our efficiency. Do we have cost savings mechanisms? Do we do any of these things? And Madam Chair, I'm quite pleased to inform the committee that we do have a what we call a business productivity program. And by and large, it's a cost-saving program. And the business productivity program, Madam Chair, is also a condition that has been placed on ESCOM via the 23 billion rand equity injection that government had put into ESCOM. And Madam Chair, the target for that program in the current financial year was around 20 billion, around 17 billion. We have managed to save around 20 billion associated with that program. So we are about 3 billion ahead for this current year's the year ended 31 March 2017. From the time that the program had started, we had a target of 43 billion that needed to be saved, and we've actually saved about 49 billion. On that program. So, Madam Chair, we believe that we've been doing our bit in terms of being able to manage our costs associated with primary energy. I think, Dion, you want to talk about the affordable energy to all, and how is that implemented, and how do we ensure that it actually reaches the right people?
Chair, I think that Madam Chair, it is a very important point. But again, if you look at what the constitutional mandate is that the provision of free basic electricity is exactly with the municipalities. So ESCOM act as an agent for municipalities on free basic electricity. And therefore, municipalities need to identify, but they do it in different ways. Some municipalities provide just a certain amount, which is above, but they then must add their own funding to that if they exceed the 50 kilowatt hours per month, because government only pays out the 50 kilowatt hours as per the indigent register. We know, as most probably Salgar that needs to comment on that, but we know that some of those indigent registers are not 100% up to speed, but we from ESCOM side provide free basic electricity to those customers that are identified by municipalities, and we check it on a monthly basis. You ask what plan should be done there. So from that perspective, I think it's important that a combined task team between COCTA, SALGA, National Treasury, can even include ESCOM in it, can sit and work together to make sure that all the indigent actually indeed receive the free basic electricity. The ESCOM support for free basic electricity, for supporting the poor, we do it through, as I've explained, through the reduced tariffs to the HomeLight 20 amp customers, which are our lifeline tariff, and they indeed get the reduction in that. And while I'm on that, I think the similar thing is the issue around public lighting. Maybe I should just talk about that. Again, it's a constitutional mandate for municipalities to provide public lighting. ESCOM's mandate from that side is only to provide us a connection point. And municipalities connect to ESCOM at the appropriate tariff that's available. So it's, and it's normally our, we call it the business rate, tariff, which they then purchase in bulk from us, and they do the distribution of the provision of public lighting. It's not an ESCOM mandate. In areas where ESCOM specifically supplies smaller municipalities, we still supply the electricity there. We do that, and then we also charge the municipality the appropriate rate from that perspective. So it is the standard ESCOM approved rate. If they require in the smaller municipalities, the only additional charge there, but it's a separate contract, it's not a tariff contract, it is a maintenance contract where we provide maintenance to the street poles, but that is in small municipalities where they cannot provide it itself, and even that I don't think is 100% cost effective. So I think it's those two questions. I don't know if there are others.
Thank you. And then we had another question around Munich debts and how do we fix these things. Madam Chair, I think first and foremost, maybe we should address the concern around hospitals and schools and the like. I think where we certainly, before we engage in load shedding of municipalities, also turning off of municipalities, We certainly do look at these emergency services and actually try and make a plan associated with how the emergency services will still be allowed to function. So that I'm aware of. In terms of some of the issues that we encounter in terms of the Munich debt, Madam Chair, the municipalities through SALGA have asked for certain concessions to be made from ESCOM, like when they pay the debt, whether they pay it on the 15th or the 25th or of the month, whether they pay interest at 2% plus prime or 5% plus prime, as to whether they pay for connection charges associated with the infrastructure, and whether there is compounding interest on debt. And the reason I bring this up, Madam Chair, is because the solution, as I said, is not only an ESCOM solution. I think it's a joint solution between national government, provincial government, local government, as well as ESCOM and government departments. And to that extent, I think there is an IMC that is currently being, well, has been established a while ago. They're just looking at a long-term solution for this problem. And the reason why I brought up those concessions that SALGA was looking for, because it actually emanated through this IMC that ESCOM was required to look at these considerations. So from an ESCOM perspective, Madam Chair, I think we are certainly doing whatever we can to be able to create an environment where we have a sustainable Munich debt problem, if you want to call it that. We certainly don't want to be in a position where we put the municipalities out of business or we stifle growth within those municipalities. And certainly from an ESCOM perspective, I can assure you that that is not our objective. We certainly will work with all and any stakeholders to be in a position to actually ensure that we support economic growth in our country. And to the extent that the SALGA concessions that were required, I think the board has favorably considered those options, and we will certainly be moving towards implementation of those five concessions that were agreed at the IMC, or certainly at the last IMC that I attended. So, Madam Chair, we are certainly doing everything that we can do from our side, from an ESCOM perspective.
Chair, if I can add on the municipal debt, I think from a government perspective is that I think we've done a lot of work with COPTAT and the National Treasury and SALGA on the municipal debt, and we've produced a number of reports. And there certainly are, you know, a number of things that are worrisome and the key drivers for the status of the municipal debt. And Honourable Julius raised the issue earlier on about disconnection from an ESCOM perspective for non-payment of debt. I actually don't think that is the key driver in terms of security of supply for the players that sit in the municipal side. We think there are some serious infrastructure issues related to the last mile of energy delivery in the municipal areas, and that if we don't deal with the viability and some of the capacity issues within the municipalities, it will stifle some of the economic activities that we want to see in the municipalities. So we've said with SALGA and the technical task team, and we think we need to make some firm commitments towards dealing with the technical and the non-technical issues that are driving the issues around the viability for some of the municipalities. So while debt is a very obvious way to see how the problem manifests, from a network performance perspective, I think we do have some serious issues. And I think that's why it's difficult for some people to actually believe it when ESCOM says we are no longer load shedding, because in their areas they do see power cuts quite regularly, and that's simply because the distribution infrastructure in some areas just does not perform.
Any other questions? Follow up?
Madam Chair, I think we just got one question from you, which was your final question to respond to, associated with who regulates the municipalities. So I don't know, Dion, if you want to take that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, you asked the one size fit all and how the consistency is. And I think just factually, the NERSA has the mandate to regulate all prices of all licensees. What happens with municipalities, with ESCOM, NERSA very much focus on the cost of supply, and they look at the cost, how do you allocate the cost to the different customer categories. and it's based on cost, and then the price is compared to that, and then the decision is taken. When it comes to municipalities, NERSA follow a different approach because most municipalities it's difficult for them to provide the cost. So their regulatory methodology there is almost as a benchmarking of the different sizes of municipalities compared to other similar sized municipalities, ignoring any cost of it. Now that has a danger because if you don't look at the cost and you just determine the price, you can under or overprice the whole thing in terms of the benchmark because the cost differs from municipality to municipality. So I just knowing from my experience is that where municipalities feel that there are specific projects and programs that they can do or there's a very good reason, they can then apply because the National Treasury, or not National Treasury, NERSA sent out normally a municipal tariff guideline out for price increases. And then it says if you stay within that benchmark, you don't have to come and apply again. We will approve your rates at that. If you have any maybe higher issues, then you can come to NERSA and you can apply for a higher increase than that. But in terms of ERA, NERSA should still approve those rates. And the approved rates, and if you're not sure whether they really do apply the approved rates, NERSA normally provides the approved rates for municipalities on the NERSA website. And if you're not sure whether if municipality may be outside of that, you can go on the NERSA website and check whether the rates that they charge is the correct ones. And if they're not charged the correct ones, you can go to NERSA. So that's just from my side.
Thank you very much. I can allow three or four questions for us. Can
Thank you for such a... just to bring one fact to the table is that, you know, ESCOM did not decide on 2.2. So the issue of prudency, the issue of in-line, is actually you were brought into line by NERSA. You still need more money for sustainability. You need more money. You asked for more money. But, you know, you don't bring out the facts. You know, it's almost as if the facts are obfuscated in here. The reality is NERSA said 2.2%, you wanted more. Now, in 2018-19, you applied for a tariff increase of 19%. Basically extending your expenses. Can you elaborate on that? What's the necessity of a 19%? Thank you, Chair.
The last that I also want to refer to, maybe it's only a comment, I don't know, that's where the thing is coming in that we must call all those to talk about the thing of the municipalities. We've been at the oversight, the honourable members, Nita Ken, and even, Honourable Nita was, because you've spoken on that one, at that oversight. It was a board, the water board issue, but it's the same.
Mm.
The revenue collection for those municipalities is less than the agreement that they have for the water board to pay back, you know, the debt. So that is the kind of thing that we are talking about. It's not that we are not sensitive for to ESCOM for increases, but the reality is the reality. That's why I'm saying we need to speak to government to look at some model. The one is, like the Honourable Mita was saying, your indigenous register must be upgraded because there is people that, you know, don't get what they're supposed to get. But the other end is looking at the unemployment rate in specific areas. There we could see that the agreement, they cannot adhere to it because where's the other cost that they have to pay? So I do understand the difficulties, but you need to look at other options, and that's why my question then is the option I was at ESCOM in Eskom's office. And the explanation or the report or the discussions was like they are looking at different options to put prepaid meters or some kind of thing. We need to look at the alternatives. We cannot go on as we want to go on. Thank you, Honorable. Honorable Dr. Freeland.
Thank you, sir. I think my understanding of the discussions is that Eskom is saying he has not replied to the submission of SALGA, because the submission of SALGA, it deals with 1819. That is the understanding that I have. And it's not dealing with the 2.2%, which it was historically approved, okay, in the previous years. I think, Chair, I will concur with the suggestion that says it would be important to bring all parties under one roof. Yesterday on the debate on COGTA, we said we have an agreement with SARS, okay, to deal with the issues of collections and how do you have a credible indigent register for municipalities. The second thing that it's always a common knowledge is that we always believe that municipalities are the same, but municipalities are not the same. Okay. And you can look, that is proven in the Eskom municipalities that are owing, most of them. Okay. So it is important that to have that fora where every body, every stakeholder is brought and really look into the matter insofar as of how to address it.
Thanks, Chair. Just for information purposes, because Parliament has a number of committees. Sometimes we present different things to different committees. I would like to put it on record that we appeared together with Eskom, National Treasurer, FFC, and COGTA to the Appropriations Committee, the Select Committee. There is a process underway which is going to lead to a joint session of these committees to deal with this matter once and for all. We had indicated the extent to which we have more issues where there is divergence than convergence between ourselves and Eskom, to a point where that could lead to a serious legal engagement on these matters. The NCOP has requested that it be allowed an opportunity to facilitate a useful conversation on these matters to avoid any of such possibilities. So I just wanted to raise that so that it is on record.
Thank you very much, Honorable.
I think, Chair, the piece of information that we have just received, it's helping moving forward in terms of the challenges between Eskom and the municipalities, because I was going to make a proposal that talk about the 2032 municipalities that are unable to pay Eskom, because it should be part of our program as the Select Committee to see to it how do we rescue the situation, help Eskom as well as the department with SALGA, you know. So I think these 32 municipalities should form part of what the previous speaker have spoken about, of beginning to address the reasons as to why the municipalities are not paying, and also the remedial measure in terms of dealing with this. Because I'm worried about what the presenter was saying. If these 32 municipalities continue not to pay, it may balloon the 9 billion that he was referring to. And we don't want to find our situation in that space. So so we don't want it to go there. So let's lift this issue as of 32 municipalities as part of our program that will link to the negotiations that are already taking place. NCOP had this as a program moving forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I think that was a very
Chair, I've got another meeting. Can I leave?
Yeah, you will. Going to the house. I think it was very fruitful for me. At least there was two sides that we could listen to. And not one is saying and one is saying, and then maybe at the end of the day you're so confused that you don't understand.
Sorry to stop you there, and sorry to do that, but we still need the responses.
Is there still outstanding
responses? Yes.
Okay, so it's only one question. I have two questions that we asked. Sorry, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, in terms of the comments that were made by the Honourable Member, I don't think we ever, as ESCOM, portrayed the fact that we only asked for 2.2. The comment that we made was that NERSA grants us 2.2. So we never said that, listen, we wanted 2.2 and therefore it's so low. You're right in that NERSA has granted us 2.2 and we live with what we have. And in terms of the fact that facts are obfuscated, well, I don't know what facts are obfuscated, but the fact is that ESCOM is living with a 2.2% tariff increase. We have not come and asked for a government guarantee. We have not come and asked for additional government guarantees. We certainly have not asked for an equity injection. Notwithstanding the fact that we have a 2.2% tariff increase, we have not threatened the country with load shedding, which would probably have been the case 36 months ago. The Honourable Member's pet peeve is diesel. We certainly have excess capacity, so we're not using diesel. And all of that with a 2.2% tariff increase. So those are the facts. What of those facts are obfuscated? I'm not too sure. In terms of the financial sustainability of ESCO, with the grace of the government guarantees that we have of $350 billion from the government, we believe that we'll be able to have an entity that will be able to provide electricity to the South African economy. In terms of being able to navigate ESCOM out to a point where it's financially sustainable will take a number of years, and we believe that that should happen in the next 7 odd years, depending on the tariff trajectory that we get and the cost efficiencies that we can extract as an organization. And a journey towards there, Madam Chair, is the 19% tariff application that we've submitted. What that tariff increase NERSA will determine, we are not aware. We don't know. The 19% is a function of the methodology that NERSA has published. So all we merely do is we comply with that methodology. Just like the 22 billion RCE applications that are currently there, those are in terms of NERSA's methodology and rules. ESCOM doesn't create these things. It is there, we apply it, and NERSA adjudicates. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my response. I think in terms of the other questions that were posed, it was really around, I think, for the committee to decide on how you want to take this vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And I can now say thank you very much. I hope so. There is no outstanding issue. Honourable Julius?
Outstanding.
No,
I don't think so, Chairperson. I'm happy with
not actually happy with it.
Further details, I'll ask a written question on that, because I strongly think that there's a decrease in sales in ESCOM that we don't know about now. We didn't hear about it. It definitely impacts on the 19.9% increase. So I'll ask a question on that. That's the type of obfuscation that I was talking about. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for the presentation. And thank you for the responses. I know that the process is like follow, or like we going to do a declaration. Am I right or wrong?
Thank you. Because this matter was referred to the committee just has to publish a report to say that we've dealt with the matter. But because we don't have a quorum today, or right now, this report can be adopted in the next meeting so that the House can deal with it, because the House cannot deal with it until the committee has concluded its process. It's process related. So as soon as the committee reports that we've concluded our deliberations or we've closed on the matter, the House will then step in and continue. So the committee report will be done in the next meeting, and then the House will take up the matter.
Thank you.